The Babylon Podcast was our last best hope for B5 fans. A self-contained show, 1 hour long, located on an RSS feed. A place for interviews and episode discussions for a whole bunch of humans and aliens. A shining beacon in cyberspace, all alone on the web. It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, the year the Lost Tales came upon us all. This is the podcast about the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2007. The name of the show is the Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
Gobble, 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 gobble. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it's happy for you, but what about the turkey?
Well, you know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That whole thing about you can soar with the eagles or you can something with the turkey. Eat the turkey, I think, is how that saying goes. Yeah.
Yeah.
They never say, anyway.
Now, I really wonder, I really wonder what would have happened if Ben Franklin had got his way and the turkey was the national bird of the United States instead of the eagle.
We'd be eating eagles on Thanksgiving.
Oh, no.
It would have made no sense until the current administration.
Wow.
I think we would have been sitting around going, we would have been sitting around saying, eat more chicken.
Eat more turducken.
Turducken, there you go, turducken.
That's right. We had this conversation a year ago, didn't we?
Did we?
I would guess if somebody had the time or lack of brilliance to go back and actually listen to last year's Thanksgiving show, they would find out that indeed we talked about turducken, because I think Tim's got a little fascination.
That was
a holiday tradition.
Yeah, you know? we do at least one turducken every year, either Thanksgiving or Christmas. Yeah, it had to have been. Oh, I think Tim was here too. I bet Tim was on the show.
That's possible.
So there you go.
Could be. But yes, that also leads to the information we should pass on to our loyal and varied listenership, which is that
next week we won't be here.
Yeah, right, exactly. But we'll be in the turkey tryptophan coma.
Yeah, but we'll be here in spirit though. We have a special treat for them. There will be a show in the feed. It just won't be us.
And it's in Spanish, right?
No.
It's in Narn.
Hijacking some other podcast from down the street and replaying it on our feed.
No, it is vaguely, partially, actually a lot Babylon 5 related. It's just not us. Do you want me to tell you?
Well,
I don't know about it.
Surprise.
He's not very good at secrets, is she?
Okay. Well, no. You sound like you want to know.
I do.
All right.
Our good friend
and
Kurt.
And we have a whole hour to kill. So.
Right. This is true. Our good friend Kurt recorded Claudia Christian's panel at DragonCon, and we have that.
Thank you, Kurt.
We have
that's
that.
That's great. Hey, that's a special promotable announcement.
Yes.
That's a good thing.
So we're going to get to hear Claudia's panel at DragonCon, and Brad did the editing.
the amazing Brad.
To take all the bad words out. I'm sure that was quite a task.
Yeah, it took him a while.
Because we know what Claudia speak is all about, don't we?
Yes, we do, firsthand. The only Babylon podcast we had to put a disclaimer in twice.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure that the show that she's going to air next week for us is probably going to be cut down to about 3 minutes.
I like Claudia more and more, the more I get to know her.
Yeah.
Oh.
Strangely enough, she seems very unlike her character on Babylon 5. But.
I'm thinking she's feeling the same way about you, Mike.
Really?
Mm. I'm sure, yeah.
Okay. I'll be stalking her this week then.
Chicks dig the mixer.
Oh, no, you didn't.
Oh. Yeah, it's not about size. It's how many sliders you have, right?
That's right. And how you slide them.
Oh, boy.
I am so not going there.
Here we are. This is supposed to be take two.
Don't bring up the fader.
Mm-hmm.
Can you please ask for donations?
Donations?
Donations. You know, there's a donate button on the site.
Yes, there is a donate button on the Babylon Podcast website. There's also a cute little Netflix button. If you sign up by clicking that button, we get a couple of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Hey,
and it helps support all of the work we do and probably would help us have more to talk about.
It will certainly help keep all the servers running.
Yes, we have.
And all the domains going.
Yes, yes, it is.
Wow. Okay. It,
yes, our...
This is like the Babylon 5 telethon. Where's Jerry Lewis?
Hey, lady!
Actually, no, wouldn't that be Rebo and Zooty?
Rebo and Zooty telethon.
Yeah, Rebo and Zooty doing that for us.
Careful, I'll pull up the telethon fanfare.
Oh no, no, don't.
I'll do my Zooty impersonation.
No, don't do it. Good. But yes, feel free to donate.
That's
click
funny. You sound just like Marcel Marceau there.
I did. And you want to explain to me how that worked?
Tim got it. Summer went right over her.
No. I said, I got it. I'm like, okay, explain that one to me because this is audio, babe.
That was the Rebo and Zooty joke. Okay.
All right. Yeah.
We'll draw pictures after the show.
Thank you.
Exactly.
This was this is our second take because all the good stuff was before Mike hit the record button.
Good.
Yeah, you don't know what you're missing.
Good.
Yeah.
Is subjective.
And that would be why you listen to the live feed. Why you can find information about the live feed at...
And send money, too.
And send money, too.
We didn't say the live feed was free. There you go. That's what you need to do.
The live feed is free, but feel generous and donate.
But the pain lasts forever.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, be thankful, folks, because Mike would be charging you for every word.
No, I'm not that greedy. I just want to keep the freaking lights on.
We definitely want the servers to keep running, so we have all this nice, pretty content. We've got news. We've got Edmund and Jim now posting news to the website for us, so that's really cool. They've found some really good stuff. They found a very nice picture of JMS standing behind the Londo and Jakar 2008 poster.
Yes. Yes. Could it get any worse?
Could it get any worse? That's such a great tagline.
That's very funny.
Although I like the comment beneath that, though, if you vote for the Zathras ticket, you get 9 Zathrases for the price of the one.
There you go.
Ah, the price of the one. Wow. When we slump into B5 humor, that's
bad.
A good warning sign right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hit the eject button.
I was going to say, what we got on tap for tonight, in the midst of all this goofiness, is we're going to be deep geeking on Severed Dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And because I thought it was good to be kind to Mike, where you're saving voicemail and emails for a later show.
Thank you.
You're so considerate.
Yeah, that's one word for it.
That.
Hey, lazy. You don't have to wade through all the Joust and Frogger voicemail.
This is true.
Oh,
but
God.
If we geek properly, we should have an entire show just based on feedback for this.
Yes, exactly. Oh, and frankly, if we geek on this properly, Summer, we'll take up an hour and a half just doing that. So
sounds like a plan to me.
Okay. Well, Mike, why don't you take us out of here for the break?
Go for the geeking.
Yeah, for the geeking. Break for the geeking. I break for geeking.
This is Captain Yarsto, EAS Netherlands.
Area playing him, command post reporting.
This is NBS-1, squad leader Tijan.
We are not hostile. I repeat, we are not hostile.
The Corps is mother, the Corps is father.
I will need to protect the interests of our people.
Battles we fought here at Orion 7 in the name of freedom.
Three-Edged Sword, Episode 19, The Die is Cast.
Captain's log, EAS Netherlands, 80 days after secession. Though our scouts have only found hints of the incoming enemy forces so far, we're starting to shift into our defensive formations. It's now clear that the attack is coming, and that it's days away rather than weeks. I'd rather have had more time to integrate our latest arrivals into the fleet, but there's little point in wishing for time we were never going to get, Mark recording cut point. Connect communications. Audio only.
Captain Yarstow? Captain Drake, EAS Seth here.
Yes, Captain. What can I do for you?
I would like to go over the tactics for the coming battle in some more detail. My position on the left flank seems awfully weak to me, and I'm not too keen on those Narn fighters you assigned to watch my back.
I understand your concerns, Captain, but you're furthest away from the most likely jump zone, and we have to take a chance somewhere. We might be able to scrape together another squadron of Star Furies to reinforce the Narn, if you really think you need more fighters.
It's not the number of fighters that worries me, but the performance difference between Frosty-class fighters and Star Furies. I understand these are advanced models, but their performance in hyperspace was hardly stellar.
Then I believe I can set your mind at ease. The maintenance they've received should serve to close that performance gap.
I suppose that assurance will have to do then, Captain. Drake out.
Squad Leader Tejan, personal log. I have just completed a lovely conversation with Agent 6. I can only imagine what has transpired in the days since the battle in hyperspace, but something is happening. Even if he intends to keep his word, I have to wonder if he has the authority to make it happen. Needless to say, that would complicate matters. The last thing we need in the middle of a firefight is...
Base Commander Duprec to Commander Tejan. Please respond.
This is Commander Tejan switching to priority channel. What happened to the comm silence?
I received your message and passed it on, as per our protocol. That should have been the end of it, but then I received a message in return. I was given an encrypted file to pass on to you. I imagine the details will be included.
What did he tell you?
We are no longer alone, Tejan. Now, we have allies.
Allies? Tell me, did he happen to say anything about Rangers?
Not to me. Does it matter?
Perhaps not. Did he at least tell you who would be helping us? We've heard this before. Leftover food and supplies?
No, just that it involved mutual friends on Babylon 5, and that your work on Orion 7 may be more important than it has ever been.
First, there's a battle to be won, or at least survived. Message has been received. I suggest we resume calm silence until my plan is realized and the alliance is secured. This is Squad Leader Tejan to EAS Netherlands. Please put me through to Lieutenant Katrine.
Finally, extreme liberties were taken with established protocols, as well as a blatant disregard for the core hierarchy. The approach to the Narn was completely unauthorized and could threaten our influence over mundane authorities if discovered. These reckless tactics favored by the isolationists within the Psycops cannot be tolerated. Agent 6's key role is a troubling sign that their influence is spreading. However, I suggest leaving him in place for now. This concludes my report on Operation Dutch Courage. The Corps is Mother, the Corps is Father. Submitted by Theodore Tam, en route to EAS Pendragon. Close report. Transmit to Psycor, Earth Dome. Encryption, Anvil.
Open personal log. The Loyalists have finished their witch hunt and come up with wrist slaps all round. Not the full-scale purge they were hoping for, but they seem content with gaining the upper hand for now. Of course, the upper hand for them means assisting the Earth Force attack on Orion 7. The administration is getting even more paranoid, having already had ships at Orion 7 turn on them. These crews are heavy with night watch, and the captains have been cherry-picked. Only those who enthusiastically follow orders, especially against civilians, have made the cut. A loyal group, but I fear these opponents may require more creativity than this band of automatons is capable of. Luckily, the back channel is still in play. The alliances at Orion 7 are very fragile, and with a push in the right place, at the right time, can still fracture. It's possible that we can swing the battle and discredit the Loyalist tactics. The Corps is Mother. The Corps is Father. Close personal log.
Three-Edged Sword is brought to you by Voices of Babylon.
And we are back with Deep Geeking on a very, very, very important episode.
We're back, but I'm not crossing the picket line.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm striking against Michael.
Breathe. Breathe. I'm sorry. It just got really, really silly in here, and I'm trying to recover.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. We're ready.
Think of baseball.
Think of baseball.
Wow.
Yeah, it's going to be a good show tonight. Mm-hmm. Come on.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Let's go. Let
Tim geek for us.
Roll it.
All I was going to say is that, you know, in baseball they play with balls.
How's that job at the dress shop working out for you?
It's great. I get to stand in the window all day long and wear nice frilly things. People looking at me.
I am so going to start hanging out with these geeking sessions. Okay,
well,
go ahead.
Now we get to ask you questions.
Yes, we do.
About this. Tonight's episode we're geeking on is Severed Dreams. The pivotal episode of the entire series, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
You think that's fair?
I think that's very fair because it changes the entire character of everyone who we've come to know. It literally changes the situation they're in on the station. It changes their political and their military affiliations. It literally takes the entire Babylon 5 universe that we know as a snow globe and shook it up really, really hard.
And I was going to say, and then dropped it on the floor, but that's for a later episode.
Yes.
So let's get to the important stuff first. Jeffrey, how many crowd scenes were you in?
That's a great question. I have no idea. Probably more than one.
Yeah, there we go. I was looking for you, actually, this time around.
I was the good-looking guy in the corner.
Oh, that good-looking guy in the corner. Well, this particular show opens up with another particularly good-looking guy, Londo Mollari, trying to come through the customs line, and he's grousing to some poor hapless fellow who is not Jeffrey about the situation and how miserable it was and why the line's taking so long, and it must be because of the NARS, because they're so inefficient. And, of course, at that point, he steps right up to the guard at the gate, and it's a Narn, who very gleefully tells him that there's something wrong, Ambassador, with your identicard, and I must have entered the information in wrong. I'm so inefficient, so please stand to one side. And
that whole scene, I just get a good kick out of it because it was so well done. The comedic
and the
timing
Narn is just so glee.
Yeah.
You know, he's so filled with glee.
Yeah. The comedic timing of that was just wonderful.
Yes. Yeah. He gets to feed it back to Mollari. And, of course, we immediately get the juxtaposition as Mollari continues to grouse about how none of this would happen if the Earthers hadn't started fighting amongst themselves. And then we cut to
a battle.
And Alexander being chased by the Clarkstown. And it's a vicious battle. And Major Ryan, who's in command of the Alexander, is resisting the exhortations of his first officer to open fire on the Clarkstown, because otherwise they're getting pounded, and we need to jump. Well, I'm not going to strand the fighters. Well, then we need to start shooting back. What are you going to do? And, of course, you know, the Major makes the fateful decision to open fire, and simple matter of few shots at the Clarkstown is destroyed. And that's, you know, especially juxtaposed with that scene with Mollari and the Narn, the quiet tragedy of it. So, did you ever meet the captain of the Clarkstown?
Yeah.
The general introduced me to him. He's got a wife, three children.
Abyssinian cat named Max.
Max, yeah. And he says, that's the difference with this war. We know everyone we kill.
Mm-hmm. And you see it in his eyes when he doesn't want to shoot. He doesn't want to order, you know, he doesn't want to give that order to fire. It's just like, you know, Sheridan, when he came up against the Agamemnon, he didn't want to do it. Right. And this was different. He didn't want to, you know, Ryan didn't want to do it because he knew the people over there. He knew a lot of those people, and he knew he was going to kill them.
Yeah.
And he,
yeah.
That was the last thing he wanted to do. And you saw him just say, you know, we have no choice. We, you know, we know we're going to know everybody we kill, and we're going to have to live with that later. But right now, what can we do?
Right. And that's in a very real sense, that is for Ryan and the Alexander, that is where they're committed to the battle. And here's what's interesting, you know, as he leaves the command deck, he says, I'm going to go write a letter to both wives. And both wives.
Yeah.
Well, as it turns out, we find out that General Haig was killed. So he's going to be writing letters to you know, Haig's wife and the other commander's wife. But and see, that's what's interesting, is even with Haig's death in that attack, Ryan still doesn't want to open fire on Earth Force ships, because he doesn't want to be that person who's responsible for the deaths of his comrades, basically. I thought that was rather poignant.
Yeah.
And, of course, where are they going to effect repairs?
Babylon 5.
That's right. And Sheridan's response when he finds this out?
Oh, hell.
Right. Well, we're in it now. Yeah.
Yeah. No, seriously. I mean, like, it's where do every scene in this episode has something important in it.
Oh, and poignant, too. Even at this point, with, as they say, hell's riding in with them, they know what's going to happen. They still sit there. Not sit there, that's not the right word, but they are desperately hoping that it's not going to come to what it comes to.
Mm-hmm. And at this point, you have to hope that they realize, or they know that they realize, they have 6 hours before the Alexander arrives. And yet they're still hoping that, you know, something will happen to make
right.
it all better before they have to actually jump in with both feet. And you're going, no, it's too late for that. You know this.
Even when the Alexander is arriving, what does Sheridan tell the command crew on the CNC deck?
Mm-hmm.
We will render humanitarian aid. I know what you've heard about the Alexander, but we wear the same uniform, and we will help them.
Yes.
You know, even that's still trying to hold out the hope that they won't have to get involved. They won't, even though, and it's, well, you know, as Sheridan says, they pick sides, and as he says, you know, we make our choice. We've made our choices. You know, you pay your money, you play the game, and you take what happens. But he says there's a lot more riding on it than just their little group. And, you know, we get that great scene when they hear that the task forces are arriving. Your favorite shot, Summer,
the push-pull thing. Yeah.
And it works so effectively. The dialogue is still continuing on around him, describing the situation, but you don't, you know, it fades too, like it's fading for Sheridan. You know,
yeah.
Just that moment, he knows, got to make a stand. You know, there's no other way now.
Yeah, and I think that shot, I've always loved that shot, because you see, it gives you a sense of disorientation, and you get the feel that when Sheridan hears that, his own internal world flipped around, and he's trying to get his balance back, you know, take a breath and go, okay, everything that I thought I could do, I can't do now, and I have to do something else.
Right.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah. And it's in his eyes. So that's, you know, this is one of Bruce Boxleitner's finest performances.
Mm-hmm.
Just every gesture and every word, you can see how conflicted he is about the situation. But as they say, you know, they don't have a whole lot of choice. And of course, once they start bombing Mars, when the Clark's forces start bombing the Martians, because they refuse to accept the declaration of martial law, and Proxima 3 and Orion 7 break away, well, they got to stand together.
Tim, did we ask Boxleitner or David Eagle about Severed Dreams when they were on the show?
Yeah, we talked with David Eagle about it, and he mentioned that shot and taking that from Hitchcock. That was one of Hitchcock's.
I'll have to remember to, you know, find those excerpts in the past, from the past, in our future shows so that we can repeat them and play off of them because there's, yeah, ooh, that's called producing. Yeah. I'm sorry. Did I say that out loud?
Yes, you did.
I'm sorry.
Jeffrey, you're obviously not getting paid enough to do this show. You deserve it.
I happen to check out TV.com's episode summary here, and there's a little bit in here I didn't know anything about.
Really?
I didn't. The little note here, this is news to me. It says here that Joe Straczynski met actor Everett McGill on the set of Twin Peaks and wanted to cast him in the role of Major Ryan. Unfortunately, he could only remember the actor's last name, and his staff contacted Bruce McGill to play the role. And while this surprised Straczynski, when he arrived on set, it became a happy accident as he was very pleased with McGill's performance.
Yes.
I never heard that.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Never heard that. I was standing right there. Bruce was a great guy. And when he showed up, I was like, oh, it's that guy. Holy cow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. You know, I don't know who he is.
Yeah, it was like when I saw him come on, I'm like, hey, we can have an Animal House reunion right here.
Right, right.
But no, because what was it? There's an outtake. There's a blooper outtake where he comes out, where he says, you know, where's General Haig? And it's like his agent double booked him, so we had to kill him or something.
Well, that's what it says here too. I didn't know that was a.
That either? Yeah, and you know what show Foxworth got booked on?
Deep Space Nine.
Deep Space Nine, exactly.
And decided he'd rather do Deep Space Nine.
These were all little tidbits that I just, you know, wasn't privy to when it unfolded.
Well,
exactly.
You need to be a bigger fan there.
No, I think they were overworking him back then, so he didn't notice. I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt.
that could be. But, you know, he also could have chosen Babylon 5. Right there. Yeah. But in a sense it works well for the story because it also drives home how deadly the conflict is.
Mm-hmm.
We've met Haig; he's Sheridan's contact in the growing resistance against Clark, and in the battle he's killed. You know, so in a very real sense, he's on his own. You know, he doesn't have anybody to look to take orders from, if you want to cast it in a sense of being a soldier.
It also brings home that nobody is safe. I mean, the general, the person that Sheridan was most looking to for guidance in this silent coup, well, what had been a silent coup, is gone. And now he's literally in position to be the one everyone looks to.
This episode does a great job of building up the tension. You've got that. You've got Captain Hiroshi, who shows up with the Churchill, basically telling Sheridan that Clark's already dispatched a fleet coming your way. You know, it's not like we just found this out. And, you know, it's a very good guess that they were coming anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that tension gets ramped up. We have a Minbari Ranger, a severely wounded Ranger, shows up on station. He brings a dire announcement to Delenn, basically that the Shadows are on the move, that the Shadows have been playing everyone against each other.
Mm-hmm.
So everything's fractious.
And more importantly, says that the Grey Council doesn't care.
And you know what? It's something that I caught, or I guess really for the first time, or maybe I noticed, but I'd forgotten. When he delivers that line, that Ranger, there are tears in his eyes.
Yeah.
And the pain that he feels isn't just from his wounds. And that leads to another great performance. Mira Furlan's performance in this episode is also fantastic. She when she goes storming into the Great Council.
Wait. tell me what episode she wasn't great in.
Oh, don't get me wrong. No, this isn't like a one off that somehow she hit it. It's just like the intensity. The episode is so intense. The script is, and everybody rises to that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when she goes storming in and she says, And the one guy stands in front of her and says, they're not going to see you. And she goes, oh, wait a minute, I don't think so. They won't see me, but they'll listen to me.
Oh, yeah.
And just lays them out. You know, I've served for 13 years. I helped Dukat when he died. His blood is on my hands. His words on my lips.
His spirit in my eyes. Move aside, or I will rip this ship.
To veil his name, I'll rip this ship apart until I find them.
And then someone is like, okay, I'll just go over here now.
Yeah.
Is the angry lady gone yet?
Right.
But Ryan is also the one that says, right, you know, he says, bring us closer to the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Right? How close? Right down their throats. Everybody's angry.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
It was sort of a pissy show, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Issues.
A little bit of anger issues. There's some working out to do here,
that's
but it's okay.
Good. Let it out.
But
right.
Yeah, no, just having everything happen at the same time. You've got, you know, the wounded ranger giving her the bad news that the Grey Council isn't coming to the Babylon 5's defense, that...
Right.
Literally, Babylon 5 is about to be besieged by its own people. She's leaving. Sheridan's prepping for war, and he doesn't know who on his staff, you know, is going to, like, run for the hills when it's done.
Yeah.
It is a lot of tension there.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when he calls his dad.
Yeah. That was...
Just, you know,
Hey,
just
that's
that moment, even as he's waiting for the connection to be made, you can just feel how tense, how distraught he is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then he puts on the brave face. Hey, Dad, how are you?
We saw Rance Howard a couple times, didn't we, in the
mm-hmm.
series?
Yes.
Yeah, I think this was the second time. No, this was the first time we
first
actually
time.
Saw Rance Howard as Sheridan's dad.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but from here on out, he was always.
And then, of course, we did see him as a manifestation. Kosh used him as a manifestation.
Yes, that's so. Later.
Yes, much later. Actually, not that much later about it. But anyway, so we get ahead of ourselves. But that's a great call. You know, you can tell how much Sheridan loves his dad, mm-hmm. how much he wants to make it just a call, you know, just calling to see how you doing and, you know, so, well, I can't tell you much over an open channel. And his dad's like, I pay attention to the news. I know what's going on.
Yeah,
don't worry about us.
Yeah. And that whole thing was like, you know, you go do what you have to do. And, but you know, his favorite line, you know, remember what I taught you. You know, don't start a fight, but, you know, definitely finish it.
Finish it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Sheridan says it again. And it's great when he says it. It's not even like this big, massive pronouncement in front of the troops to rally them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he says, so, you know, as the and it, how easy it was slip into that, the enemy Star Furies. You know, you automatically got to start thinking of them as the enemy, you know. And he tells the Babylon 5 Fury squadrons, you know, target, be prepared to attack, but don't shoot first. You know, we're not going to start it, but by God, we're going to finish it.
Mm-hmm.
And the ships... The sheer number of ships in those scenes is just breathtaking. I was watching it again. I had it on the we've got our DVD player running through the stereo, so I basically had all the speakers going really loud. Brought the kids into the room. It was great. And that battle scene is really a tense battle scene. And a lot of that, as you know, is because – now we're seeing the results of decisions that people have made.
Yeah.
But even with all that, it's just that when the Churchill goes plowing into the other ship, oh my God, it's heartbreaking.
Let me share something that I just read here that I didn't really recall happening. It says, near the end of the battle, one of the ships loyal to Clark takes heavy damage from the shots fired by B-5, the Alexander, and by... the B-5 Star Furies. Sheridan then issues the communique to the ship stating that Sheridan to the Roanoke, your mm-hmm. ship is badly damaged.
Right, right.
Surrender and let us take on prisoners. We promise safe passage and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
At that point, the ship that is hitting isn't the Roanoke. It's the Agrippa.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a couple of little...
It's a little
digital boo-boo
yeah,
there.
Yep,
there, yeah.
little blue. Actually, it was a little, probably a dialogue boo-boo. Because he's talking about the Roanoke, and the Roanoke's already been destroyed.
Yeah, I was going to say, because the Roanoke, looking at it, I think it was the Roanoke that got plowed by the Churchill.
So that happens. I can understand mm-hmm. how that would have happened. Yeah. I mean, typically didn't let that – and I can tell you that John Copeland, producer John Copeland, would never let something like that get away, but obviously it did happen this time.
Well, here's –
And for what it's worth, you know, we bring it up and we're aware of it because –
We've watched it 500 times.
We've watched it, 150 times. And
no. You?
Yeah, you think?
Here's something else. Did you realize that during that one scene, the fire that broke out behind Sheridan's head was a real fire? And that was a real, you know, somebody who ran in there, a PA gave the guy a fire extinguisher to put it out?
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
This is the wonder of Babylon 5. There's more folklore that has become truth. God bless the internet. If I would have had any idea way back then, I never would have got that station.com going. Good God, I can't. You're telling a PA brought a fire extinguisher.
And one of the extras. Yeah.
Yeah, a PA gave it to the extra, and the extra who was in uniform for the bridge ran up and put out the little fire. Yeah. It was a real fire. You could tell that was real.
Right.
Well, it might have been a real fire, but it's not like it was out of control.
It wasn't out of control. It's just the explosion for that panel set whatever, you know, drywall or whatever was on the side of it on fire, and they're like, okay, we got to put that out, but we got to finish, you know, we got to keep rolling.
Okay, all right. Well, that may be true.
Yeah.
And my guess is that was probably a stunt person or part of our special effects team,
But would they have been dressed in a CNC uniform?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool.
Because we knew that it had to happen, because we knew that there was the potential of our silly plywood space station burning down anytime we use pyrotechnics. Yes. We weren't that
dumb. That goes part and parcel. Here's another one we should have pulled up pieces from, our interview with Maggie Egan.
Oh, yeah.
Remember when she talks about that scene when ISN gets closed down and all the crap comes falling down the ceiling?
And it, like, hits her in the head.
More and closer than than she had anticipated.
Damn, that's good television.
That is.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that scene is good too, where they, you know, she's just delivering the pronouncements and the guy shows up with the microphone. Okay, Jane, I got to break in here. Yeah. And she's like, you don't have to do this.
It's like, yes, we do. They're bombing Mars. And literally that tension of ISN going black and everybody not knowing, they don't have a lifeline back home anymore.
Yeah.
That actually adds to the tension of what everyone's doing when the battle starts.
You know, and that was certainly more poignant when originally broadcast at that time, because that is truly still the days when CNN was kind of the bomb,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
they were the one, the real deal. They were on all the time and that sort of stuff. And we were largely
nobody else is doing it. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. Since 9/11, now everybody's 24/7 news constant, you know, and all that sort of stuff.
Well, and again, it's in the whole art reflecting reality. It's Mira Furlan, her speech that she delivers to the Grey Council. Mm-hmm. She basically drew on what she felt about her home nation of Yugoslavia falling apart at that same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, while the words are written to a fictional situation, the emotion behind them are very, very real.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And that just makes that makes it that whole scene more powerful, because you feel the emotion behind her words. You can actually see it on her face at one point.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was very, very distraught with Milosevic and was very vocal about that. So that's it makes perfect sense, and it's, you know, kudos to Joe for pulling that out, because it was there on the table for the taking.
Yeah. And I think David was talking about how that whole scene where she's in there talking to the Grey Council was one continuous shot, and it would have been one continuous shot, but she couldn't break the staff. So they had to, like, you know, cheat it.
I remember that.
I remember that too.
Oh, that was a sad thing.
Yeah.
That was a real tension. The icebreaker kind of thing, yeah. You know.
Yeah. And that's also
the one where Jerry broke his arm, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Can you tell us more about that? Because they said that he broke his arm during that melee, but in the next episode he doesn't have a cast, but the one following that he does have a cast.
Well, that's editing.
Okay.
And we shot completely out of sequence too. So that makes perfect sense that could happen. And there's nothing you could do about it. Yeah. I don't remember. I suspect I wasn't there when that happened, because I seem to recall that it all happened, or I found out about it well after the it happened. I also think, you know, because he's such a tough nut, he probably broke it and then just got up and kept on doing his thing.
Mm-hmm.
Was until the end of the day.
Right. That's what I understand happened. Is it?
Yeah. That's very Jerry. Yeah.
And I love that scene when they're getting ready to take on the Earth Force breaching pod gang, and here comes Garibaldi with his troops. Okay, we're gonna set up here. We'll wait for him to break through, and the Narns just go running on by.
Yeah.
It's like nuts.
Yep. And you realize it's like, okay, you know, we have to go back them up, but geez, they're pulling us out of position. We have a great bottleneck right here, and we gotta tell Jakar to let them, you know, follow my orders. But yeah, that's
those are great sequences too, with the firefights and the hand to hand combat. I mean, it's just the brutality of it. It really is driven home. You know, there's nothing heroic about what's going on with any of this.
Yeah.
You know, it's desperate people doing desperate things. And
sounds like Thanksgiving.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Except there's no gravy on the table.
No, but yeah, that was that whole, when you see that when it goes into slow motion and the Narn are just running into that room and being picked off one by one.
Yeah.
I remember the first time watching that going, my God, stop. Duck and roll, please do something.
And
they're just being slaughtered. They're just running right into the line of fire. I'm like, what? Why? And
they're Narn, and they're hot-headed. But it's the shock and awe. I mean, here we go. There's one. But that's what it is. They just kept coming. You know, and they eventually, you know, and that final sequence where the camera pans across the room full of bodies, and you know, it's not even at one point. I think you look in there. There's one of the attackers, one of the invaders, lying there, twitching as she's dying. And it's like it stops being an us and them situation and just you know, people dying. And it's in a real. I mean, that's the amazing thing about the episode is it's not. It's just full of tension and it's dramatic and. You don't ever get the sense, even though our heroes, quote unquote, win out in the end, you don't get a sense that it's a victory.
No, you know, it's a survival. Yeah, we just.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And they really only get by through the help of Delenn, and that's a great scene and one of the fan favorites in terms of dialogue. After they defeated the Orinoke and the Agrippa, they're trying to take some damage reports, and then in comes three more ships. Through the jump gate, like they were just waiting, and Sharon's like, "Oh, great!" And then Corwin announces four jump points opening on top. That, you know, and you just see it in Sheridan's face. He just closes his eyes. It's like, okay, what happens next? And there's Delenn.
Yeah, I mean that one scene.
Only one human captain has ever survived a Minbari fleet, and he is behind me. You're in front of me,
yes.
So if you value your life.
Somewhere else.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. Just that whole scene where he's
that's like that rocks more than anything else. That was the
yeah.
That was the one that totally gets the hair on the back of your neck standing up, and you go, oh yeah, oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean that whole scene. You've got the tension of, you know, the battle being over. It you've got the high tension from the battle, the lowering of the tension from the battle. Ending, even though there's damage, and you see Sheridan start to relax, and he asks Corwin, you know, give me a damage report, and then he starts to process a damage report, and all of a sudden you hear, oh no, and it's going to start all over again, and they can't take any more hits, and then you've got one just group coming through the jump gate, and you see it on his face. He's ready to give up.
Right. It's like, you know, we give it our best shot, but there's, you know, there's just too many of them, and what else can we do?
Yep. And then the land comes in, and you're like, oh, cool.
Yeah. Right. And you know, after she delivers her line, you know, the attacking Earth Force vessels, we'll get you and your little dog too, or anything like that. They just turn around.
Yeah, like, oh yeah, we remember that. Okay, going now.
Yeah, right. yeah. And then we've got the scene of all the Night Watch people being paraded away.
Mm-hmm.
Sheridan and Garibaldi talking about that, and I love that because there's more pragmatism again. It's not like, woohoo, we beat them. It's like, okay, we round up everyone we know about, which leaves the ones we don't know about.
Yep.
We'll have to worry about sabotage, almost certainly. You know, I mean, it's just like, you know, they know that this is not a battle that's been won. It's just the first salvo in a much greater conflict.
Yeah.
You know,
and
the pragmatic soldiers take over at that point.
Yeah, and you get the feeling that, you know, this Sheridan and Garibaldi know each other because, you know, Sheridan's going, okay, you know, think of the worst possible things you think someone could do and just kind of try to plan for it, please. Thank you. I leave that with you.
And then we get
this is going to be the one episode that'll get the most amount of viewer feedback, won't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably until we get to Zaha Doom.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got the great scene where Delenn comes back into the station, though, and Sheridan takes her aside.
Yeah.
And I like that line. It's like, you know what? I don't know what this costs you personally, and I suspect I'll never know, but this was one of the finest moments of my life when I saw your face. It's like, oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah, and the way she said, it's like, this is our home, both of our homes now, and how could I abandon my partner? I'm like, aw.
Yeah. I know. And you know, she's right, though. I mean, they've both severed their ties with their homeworlds and their cultures. You know, there's almost a sadness when she says that. You know, she's saying, you know, where else do I have to go now? But yeah, that was sweet. It was romantic. He kisses her hand.
I knew he was going to do something.
But you know what? You know, see, that's the thing with the giant story arc, the romance works. I mean, it's not goopy, mushy stuff. It's the two characters developing feelings for each other, you know, and it expresses itself. I think that's what gives it dimension. As Sheridan says earlier in the episode, our humanity got us into this, but it's going to be our humanity that gets us back out.
Mm-hmm.
And these are characters being human, you know?
So, well, some of the characters being human.
Well, yeah,
many of them being alien
characters being Narns, yes. And there, I, you know where you were through the whole thing. You were just back down there in the shower curtain drinking tequila.
Was that standing in lunch lineup, probably?
So were you in that final scene where everyone starts applauding Sheridan and Delenn?
I don't know about that. There, I don't know. I'd have to see it. I don't remember the scene.
Yeah, no, it's just the. It just that whole scene where, you know, they've finally come back on. They started, was it Franklin and Garibaldi start joking about, you know, Ivanova getting a bump on the head. And
yeah. Right.
And then he's like, you know, hey, we got something to show you. And everyone is there in the Zocalo, happy, alive, proud of what they've done.
Yeah.
And it looks like it's going to end on a high note. And then it ends on focusing on a sort of tattered Night Watch poster that someone sort of either splattered with paint or half tore down. I couldn't tell.
Yeah.
And
traitors can't hide.
Yeah. And you're like, oh crap. Now what?
Yeah.
And in typical B5 fashion, who are they considering the traitors? The people on B5 who've broken away, or the people in EarthGov who have, you know, caused this to happen? Who are the traitors? Who considers who the traitors?
It's not never that black and white. You know, Sheridan exhorting the captains of the Roanoke. You know, it's like, come on, you have to see that these are illegal orders.
Mm-hmm.
You have to see
he's
that.
He's trying to talk him into it. Yeah.
Right, but you could also imagine on the flip side, the guy sitting in the chair and on the Roanoke going, you know. Respect the chain of command.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not part of my job. My part of the job is to to enforce, you know, to carry out the orders I've been given, and I look at it differently. And you can see that.
That was one of the in the fifth year. There's that great scene between Lockley and Garibaldi.
Oh yeah.
You know, he's been hounding her. You know, what side were you on during the war? And she just finally says, "I was on the side of Earth, and I was on the side that says it's not the soldier's place to question what the government's doing. I was on the side that you know, I mean, just basically."
Her little, yeah.
That thing, right, exactly. You know, that she's, you know, I'm a soldier, I'm not a politician. These are not decisions for someone like me to make. And, of course, you know, we see Sheridan shedding his jacket as he goes out. I don't think I'm going to be putting that on for a long time.
I just came across a question that was probably, it's listed as unanswered. What does... Sheridan's mother do with her time?
Well,
I don't know. It sounded like she helped Sheridan's dad work the farm.
That we never saw her again, though.
No,
right?
we never saw her at all.
Right,
right. I would say she's probably working down at the dress shop with me.
Uh-huh. Rosie the Riveter on the new Thunderbolts, something like that.
There you go.
She was a team player.
Mm-hmm. I mean, think about it. She was the wife of an ambassador, a diplomat.
Right.
So she probably learned the whole, you know, social scene, social circuit scene with everything. But what does she do now that they're retired?
I imagine she's very much involved with the, you know, the ladies' auxiliary or reading to school kids or something like that. She's probably quite the social butterfly. I'm guessing that David Sheridan, the ambassador, probably drove her nuts after the first year of retirement, and she had just had to get out of the house.
I'm going bowling.
Sure as hell wasn't going anywhere. Either that or she's carrying out an illicit affair with a Vorlon.
Oh.
Is there any other kind of affair?
Not going there. Not going there. Do we miss anything? Got the ISM?
I think we pretty much hit all of it. You know, there's one little bit. I like the scene where you know, they're actually talking about breaking away, and the Bonneville looks over Corwin. You okay?
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of a surprise, but yeah, I guess I am.
Yeah.
You know, as there's the one shot where, I guess, Sheridan mentions that the Clarkston's, or the Alexander's coming in, we're going to make repairs, and you can just see it on... He says, the commander and I are aware of this. We take full responsibility. And there's the shot of Corwin with this look on his face, like, that's what she was asking me about. Oh, no.
It's kind of funny. And it kind of it kind of brings a nice close to the Ring Around the Rosies episode.
Yeah, right. Yeah, excellent episode.
Excellent episode.
It takes you through the ringer, but like you said, you're right, Summer, it takes everything and turns it upside down. Even when I was listening to, you know, watching the opening credits, and, you know, there's the voiceover, the Babylon Project was our last best hope for peace. It failed.
Yeah.
Knowing what this episode is about, that just gave me chills.
Should have won an award.
It should. Well, you know what? Summer, you might know this better than I, was out of year three, what was nominated for Hugo Awards?
I think this one was.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I made the joke. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. This is the winner for the.
Yeah, this
yeah,
is.
Yeah,
okay. This is the winner.
Work with
like
me, 7-3.
Yeah, 7-3. Yeah. This one. This is the one. Yeah, 209 and 3 was 14. No, 309.
I have.
Sorry.
You know what? I have.
Sorry, Jeffrey. I missed the softball there.
Yeah, I set you up for the. You know, I throw the toss out there and make you look good. I have a severed dream. No, maybe I don't.
You don't have your own little Hugo copy?
Oh, yes. No, I do have Hugo copies. Still shrink-wrapped, I might add.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. And I said plural copies. I was thinking of signed script, but I don't think that's true. I don't think I have my severed dreams script autographed by everybody.
I don't have any of my scripts autographed by anybody. I'm going to have to fix that.
I have my episode 422 and 522 signed by everybody.
Ooh.
Wow.
Both of them. Yeah. because we really thought at the end of the fourth season it was done. So we had a big party, and everybody signed everybody's yearbook and moved on. And then we did that again.
Oh, yeah. It was so much fun, you had to do it twice.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
Anything else, Summer?
No, I think we pretty much covered it.
Yeah.
And if we miss something, I'm sure our listeners will let us know.
They will, absolutely. So.
Well, we will take a quick break.
Everything looks good from here.
In 2002, Firefly was canceled. Browncoats didn't take that line down.
You never lie down.
We organized.
How drunk was I?
Coordinated. Engaged in guerrilla marketing.
Make the signal.
And bought the DVD box set in such numbers that before too long, we found we'd done the impossible.
That makes us mighty.
Serenity became a major motion
picture. So no more running. I am to misbehave.
Now, in 2007, Browncoats are doing the impossible.
Okay, now I can't get down.
Again.
Again. Again.
Go to BigDamnSequel.com to find out how you can help get Serenity back on the big screen. BigDamnSequel.com.
The power of the verse can stop me.
Because Serenity 2.
Can't do something smart.
Is worth fighting for.
Do something right.
www.bigdamnsequel.com.
So that'll do it for this episode of the Babylon Podcast. If you want to submit your own comments on today's Deep Geeking, that email address is babylonpodcast@gmail.com. Or if you want to send in a voicemail, that number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
Here, Mike got his new mixer.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.
This is Ambassador Delenn of the Minbari. Babylon 5 is under our protection. Withdraw. Be destroyed. Only one human captain has ever survived battle with the Minbari fleet. He is behind me. You are in front of me. If you value your lives, be somewhere else.